Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram weekend edition for Saturday, March 6th, 2021. Section A. New MISD superintendent reaches out with entry plan. To build a relationship, there has to be trust. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. For Angelica Ramsey, becoming superintendent and developing a plan isn't an overnight process. Her plan of entry will continue through October and involve stakeholder engagement, data analysis, and collective accountability. The end result, she said, is a strategic plan that she expects to publish for the community to review. Ramsey told the Reporter Telegram she wants to be on the same page as the staff, teachers, students, and community. That takes a process she has found successful in previous jobs. A plan for the first 3 to 4 months is of vital importance because there are complex dynamics underlying the educational, civic, and political issues impacting school districts, she wrote in her 10-page entry plan she presented to the board this past week. It also serves as a personal and professional learning strategy for me. The plan includes 3 stages, according to her entry plan. In stage 1, I will meet with internal and external stakeholders, including board members, students, parents, teachers, district leadership teams, central office staff, principals, local college and university administrators, professional associations, and community, faith, and business leaders. In stage 2, with the help of staff, I will analyze data collected and review our existing plans, support services, initiatives, and programs to evaluate their effectiveness and alignment with priorities. Student outcomes and allocation of fiscal and human capital will be analyzed with the voices of staff. I will report out the results of my stakeholder engagement to our board in a public board meeting. In stage 3, staff and I will take the results of the stakeholder engagement sessions as the needs assessment to begin developing Midland Independent School District's strategic plan. The plan will include short, mid, and long-term goals, commitment statements, and action steps focused on improving student outcomes for all students, creating healthy and safe environments for all, increasing two-way communication, and becoming the premier educational employer in the Permian Basin. The activities outlined in each phase may overlap as a result of need or importance. The board and the community will be updated on my progress. She said truth is what she must have, whether it is stakeholder feedback or data, and that she will publish what she learns. To build a relationship, there has to be trust, she told the Reporter Telegram. If they don't tell you the truth, you don't get the data you want. She made the point that the divergent thinker is the person she will learn from the most. She used an example of an upset teacher being someone she learned from in a previous entry plan process. That teacher said she ended up becoming part of Ramsey's leadership team. She also expects people, through this process, will learn that her leadership style does not force people or the community to conform to her. Having the community bend to you is not my style, Ramsey said. I'm sure it works for others, just not for me. I learn to connect with those people where I'm at. Ramsey also expects that schools should be the heartbeat of a community where there aren't just teachers and staff, but adult advocates for the students. That is part of the process of creating better student outcomes, she said. In the entry plan, there are also goals. They are establish a collaborative and positive working relationship between the board and superintendent to ensure a cohesive governance team, create a proposal for accelerating student achievement, establish public trust and confidence through open, honest communication and positive relationships among the stakeholder groups, increase organizational effectiveness and efficiency with high accountability standards, and establish a clear and definitive strategy to address perceptual and factual issues related to school safety, security, and climate for all schools. With each goal, there are objectives and activities. All are available at the entry plan that has been posted on the school district's website. Lastly, there are 11 questions located at the end of this article that she wants people to answer. She told the Reporter-Telegram that the ability to problem solve is only as good as the commitment that she receives from stakeholders that have the best interest of the students. She wants people willing to commit themselves to a new era of Midland, and that starts with hearing from the community. "I'm sincere when I say I want to hear what people think," Ramsey said. "I fully believe if we are going to make changes and have a strong strategic plan, that we have to do it together." Here are the 11 stakeholder engagement questions. 1. What is the most important expectation you have of me as a superintendent? 2. If you were in my shoes, what would you focus on first? 3. What do we need to do to elevate MISD to the next level? 4. Who are the most respected employees on the staff? 5. Who are the key internal and external stakeholders who are critical to our future success? 6. Can you identify the sacred cows that hinder our collective success? 7. What are 3 things that have happened in the past 3 years that you are most excited about? 8. What are 3 things that have happened in the past 3 years that you are most disappointed in? 9. What obstacles or barriers do I need to remove so that you can be successful in your role? 10. What are you willing to commit to do to make this leadership transition a success? 11. What did I not ask you that you feel compelled to share with me? Obituaries and death notices. Betty Perry Smith died on January 18th at the age of 91. On February 28th, our lives were changed when Colton Ross Huckabee went to walk with his Savior. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday at Nally Pickleham Welsh Funeral Home. Graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, March 9th, at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Shirley Irene Dye of Midland joined her Heavenly Father on March the 2nd. Visitation will be Tuesday, March 9th, at Ellis Funeral Home between 12 noon and 2 p.m. Funeral services have been scheduled for 2 p.m. Tuesday at the Ellis Funeral Home. Internment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Socorro Prieto, 73 of Midland, went to be with her Lord and Savior on Tuesday, March 2nd. Viewing will be held on March 7th from 1 to 9 p.m. and Monday, March 8th from 9 to 9 p.m. at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. A prayer service will be held on Monday evening at 7 p.m. Funeral service is set for Tuesday, March 9th at 10 a.m. at Templo Bautista La Hermosa in Midland. Burial service will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Ollie Mae Craisman, 89 of Midland, passed away on Saturday, February 20th. Viewing will be Monday, March 8th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., and the family will be receiving friends for visitation from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Monday evening at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Graveside service will be at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, March 9th at Serenity Gardens. Daniel Pickett, 48 of Monahans, died Monday, March 1st in Monahans. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by American Heritage Funeral Home of Midland. Jean Harvey Bishop, 82 of Midland, passed away March 4th. Services pending with Nally Pickleham Welsh Funeral Home in Midland. Jenna McLean, 82 of Midland, passed away March 4th. Service will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleman Welch Funeral Home of Midland. Pat Adams, age 85, passed away at her home on February 22nd. Memorial service will be held on March 8th at 2 p.m. at First Baptist Church. In lieu of flowers, Pat's family requests memorial donations be given to Delta Kappa Gamma for Storybook Christmas in Midland, or to the First Baptist Church. Roy Wallace Parham, 77 of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, March 3rd. Viewing will be Thursday, March 11th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with receiving of friends from 5 to 7 p.m. at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. A funeral service is set for Friday, March 12th at 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Winter storm highlights need to prepare for disaster, from the Better Business Bureau. In February 2021, an unprecedented winter storm swept through Texas, resulting in federal action declaring the state a disaster zone. Residents experienced extended power and water outages, homeowners faced water damage from burst pipes, and some found their food supply running low. Because severe winter weather is rare in Texas, few were ready to handle the storm. Now, Texans are wondering how to stay prepared for the future. READY is a federal campaign partnered with the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, aimed at educating Americans on responding to emergencies, including natural disasters. The campaign suggests creating a family emergency plan, building a supply kit, and taking action to help your community stay prepared. Plan ahead using these tips from READY and your Better Business Bureau. Create a plan. Take time to create a disaster plan with your family and ask important questions to assess your preparedness. How will you receive emergency alerts? Where will you shelter? Do you have an evacuation route planned? Is your disaster kit stocked? Build a kit. Having plenty of supplies can help you better navigate an emergency situation. A disaster kit should include a 3-day supply of drinking water, 1 gallon per family member per day, non-perishable food, flashlights and batteries, medications, and any important documents. Keep these items in a sealed container that can protect them from water or fire. Stay safe. In the extreme cold, Texans searched for ways to stay warm without power. Unfortunately, many suffered carbon monoxide poisoning after running their cars in a closed garage. Remember, if you decide to use your car for heat, do so in an open area. You should also take time to learn the signs of hypothermia and its basic treatments, such as warming the center of your body first. Do your research. If you are anticipating severe weather, gather information to save the valuable time during or after the disaster. You will want to locate your home's main water shutoff valve in case you need to cut off water after a pipe bursts. Reach out to your insurance agent to review what your policy covers if your home is damaged during the storm, and visit BBB.org to create a list of trustworthy plumbers, contractors, and tree services near you. Knowing who to call ahead of time can help the recovery process run smoothly. For more information on disaster preparedness, visit ready.gov. You can find trustworthy professionals at bbb.org. What went wrong with the Texas power grid? Pretty much everything. A commentary by The Economist, M. Ray Perryman. What went wrong with the Texas power grid during the recent extreme weather event? Everything, but it's complicated. One key issue is that Texas homes, buildings, and power infrastructures are geared toward dealing with the issue that we most often face, heat. Whether for an individual homeowner or a society, the decision regarding how much to spend on protecting from cold involves an assessment of the costs, benefits, and likelihood of extreme weather. As the recent historic freeze blanketed Texas, about 40% of generation capacity went offline as demand surged. Wind turbines froze and stopped working. Natural gas-fired generation initially increased, as did coal, but weather ultimately caused issues with these facilities as well. Some gas wells and pipelines were affected, and generators, which often purchase gas through interruptible contracts, were competing for supply, with the natural gas directly used to warm about 35% of Texas homes. Given the vast resources in the state, a natural gas shortage in particular is particularly difficult to stomach. Moreover, turbines, conventional power plants, gas wells, and pipelines routinely function under frigid conditions elsewhere, but winterization practices in Texas were clearly insufficient. Another issue is that much of Texas is an island when it comes to its power grid, not connected to other parts of the country. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas is tasked with ensuring peak demand can be met, yet the grid was apparently minutes away from catastrophic failure. The state certainly has the energy resources to meet its needs many times over, but choosing to go it alone brings a responsibility to set up and assure a secure power system. Placing all blame on wind energy ignores the benefits in the form of both zero emissions and lower electricity prices for Texans during much of the year. Hydrocarbon-fueled generation plants are also not the culprit, and they will remain essential to ensuring adequate capacity until at least the point when the power supply storage limitations are fully resolved. When the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, renewables are not producing power, and conventionally fueled generation must be sufficient to meet demands. Texas's relatively more competitive power market has fostered lower prices than would otherwise have been in place, and more choices for Texas consumers. We have studied this issue several times. However, the recent problems have clearly illustrated some shortcomings with the structure that must be addressed. When the historic freeze led to an all-time peak winter power demand, the grid was not up to the task, and millions of Texans suffered. Pointing fingers isn't helpful, but better oversight and thoughtful tweaks to the current market platform can help prevent another cataclysmic failure. Stay safe. Texas power death spiral was unavoidable. It's that simple. There is no one party in the electrical power generation chain on which to lay the blame, and we should quit trying. By Michael Bonsbach, marketing consultant. In 1882, Thomas Edison formed the Edison Electric Illuminating Company, which brought electric light to Manhattan. But most Americans still lit their homes with gas light and candles for another 50 years. Only in 1925 did half of all homes in the U.S. have electric power. It has been many years since the U.S. has been fully electrified, but in 2015, 1 billion people, 3 times the U.S. population, in the world had no access to electricity. Access to electricity is a key metric to determining a nation's affluence. As late as 2001, the entire country of Afghanistan was virtually without electricity. Afghani GDP was $500 per person in 2019, while the United States GDP was $65,000 per person. We have come to expect that we should have electric power 100% of the time, and when that doesn't happen, then it must be someone else's fault. Encore, Eckhart, power generators, retail electric providers like Gritty, employees and or board members of any or all of the above. There are very few who know how electric power is generated, and even fewer who understand the vast number of both mechanical and human factors that must operate seamlessly, and do operate seamlessly 99.9% of the time, to provide this modern miracle. We should really consider ourselves quite fortunate to have electricity at all, but of course we, as Americans, are smarter, better looking, and more talented than everyone else, and expect to have our every wish granted immediately. Vanity of vanities, and all is vanity, spoke Ecclesiastes. Not a few have observed that this event occurred at the beginning of Lent, forcing involuntary penance on a people who refuse even the slightest voluntary inconveniences. Within ERCOT, natural gas burned in gas turbines provides about 50% of the generating capacity in Texas, with wind and / solar at about 30%, coal about 15%, and nuclear about 5%. Since natural gas provides such a large percentage of electric power, and in an effort to find the appropriate scapegoat to Texas's woes, we first need to understand what a typical oil and gas production facility contains. A three-phase stream, oil, salt water, and natural gas, is produced from the wellhead and flows to a separator, where the gas leaves the top of the separator in the vapor phase, and the oil-salt water mixture leaves the bottom of the separator in the liquid phase and goes to a gas-fired heater treater, which applies heat to break the oil and water emulsion and separate the oil from the salt water. Oil then goes to storage tanks or pipelines, while water is either sent to a disposal well via an electric pump or trucked off the lease. Let's examine what really happened during the 221 consecutive hours with temperatures below the freezing point of water, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. The natural gas in the vapor phase leaving the separator is saturated with water vapor, and since all the functions listed above occur above ground in steel pipes and vessels, the gas quickly drops in temperature, and the water vapor can freeze in the pipeline, creating an ice block, a hydrate. If the gas cannot leave the lease, then, unless the gas is flared, the well must be shut in. Even if the gas does not freeze in the line, if the paved roads and dirt lease roads are too hazardous for 18-wheeled truck transports to pick up the oil and water from the lease, then as soon as the on-lease storage is filled, the well must be shut in. Most leases have some level of electric power for pumps, lighting, heat track tracing, or similar uses. And when the electric provider ceases to provide that power, then any efforts to restore production and unfreeze equipment are hampered. The combination of freezing within online flow lines, hazardous conditions preventing company employees from getting to the lease, lack of crude and water truck hauling, and the loss of electricity results in a complete wellhead shut-in. The graph above shows actual field production data from the Reagan County producer who battled all the issues above. Virtually 100% of the gas produced in the Permian Basin must be processed in a gas processing plant for the removal of water, hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, and valuable natural gas liquids, NGLs, which are ethane, propane, butanes, and heavier, with the remaining molecules consisting almost entirely of methane, called residue gas, delivered into large-diameter pipelines at the plant outlet. As producers struggle to keep wells on, gas processors also struggled as volumes to their plants steadily decreased, making it more difficult to operate, and they faced similar issues of employee safety, implant freezes, and loss of electricity to key pieces of equipment, like NGL pumps, if the NGLs cannot be pipelined from the plant on a continuous basis, the plant is forced to shut down. All plants have a minimum volume of gas required to run the plant, and many plants hit this wall. Navitas Processing Complex east of Midland dropped from 750,000 MCF per day to zero, while Cogent in Reagan County dropped from 460,000 per day to 40,000 per day. Assuming a total loss of wind, solar, and a 50% loss in coal, natural gas share of the remaining generating capacity rose to about 80%. When wellhead freezes dramatically, reduced gas flow to the processing plants, and when plants were having their own freeze issues, electric providers then cut power to these plants, eliminating what little gas supply was left available, effectively creating a death spiral. So, irrespective if A, power generators were properly winterized, or B, we had more gas-fired powered generation, or C, Texas was not deregulated, the fuel supply simply was not available, not even for ready money. In Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, Algernon expresses his dismay to the butler regarding why there were no cucumber sandwiches, to which the butler replied, "There were no cucumbers in the market this morning, sir, not even for ready money." After you read this comedy, you should read this his equally compelling but more somber tale, The Picture of Dorian Gray. As gas supply dwindled and power demand increased, the price for gas for ready money jumped from its normal price of $3 to $100 to $200 per BTU. But as the price of gas surged and the demand for power increased, while its availability decreased, the price of power also surged from 3 cents per kilowatt to $9 per kilowatt hour. The typical consumer reaction was that there was price gouging simply because the price increased. What we witnessed was the classic supply-demand price dynamic of the free market, which that same consumer enjoys on a regular basis when shopping for virtually any product. Gritty customers enjoyed the rewards of supply-demand price when power was plentiful and cheap, but they knew full well that they were susceptible to price spikes. Gritty updated open market prices every 5 minutes and sent alerts when the price was increasing or decreasing, so those customers had the tools available on their smartphones and could elect to cease or continue to use power at a known cost. Force majeure is a French term that literally means greater force and is related to an act of God, an event for which no party can be held accountable, such as a hurricane or a tornado, or 221 consecutive hours of 32 degrees. Try as we might, there is no one party in the electrical power generation chain on which to lay the blame, and we should quit trying. Will all the entities in the chain expend the money to protect against an event that happens once in 100 years? Will you expend the money to buy and maintain a gas or diesel-powered generator and beef up the insulation in your house to protect against an event that happens once in 100 years? Do you expect the answers to both questions to be the same? It is very unfortunate that lives were lost as an indirect consequence to the temporary loss of electricity. In another segment of our lives where man and machine interact, let's look at deaths on Texas roadways, which run about 3,500 per year. For the last 20 consecutive years, at least one person has died every single day in a vehicle accident. Are we filing lawsuits or calling for the resignation of employees of TxDOT, DPS, or vehicle manufacturers? If we are serious about reducing deaths to zero, TxDOT's 2050 goal, would we drop the speed limit to 30 miles per hour on all roadways and post officers every 10 miles to issue mandatory citations? Or would we appeal to taking personal responsibility for safe driving habits every time we turn the key in the ignition? Switching gears, What should oil and gas producers be prepared for in late March when they are paid for gas delivered in February? Just because natural gas traded for $100 to $200 per BTU for a few days does not mean you will receive that price. It depends on what your gas contract stipulates and whether the plant to which you are connected sold any gas during that period. In an effort to be equitable, gas processors who did sell some high-priced gas could possibly allocate that value to only those producers who actually delivered gas to them during that period, rather than compute an average monthly price and applying that price to all deliveries during February. If your gas processor passes through your share of its electricity bill, you could be in for a shock on high pass-through power costs. You may get inquiries from rural owners who wondering why they are not seeing the effects of $100 BTU gas and whether you exercised a fiduciary responsibility to obtain that price. This is only a partial list. The storm outside is over, but the financial and legal storm could only be beginning. Trinity's Danielle Bryden is lone Midland County student to earn coveted position on National Merit List. From staff reports. Meet Danielle Bryden. The Trinity School of Midland senior is not only Midland County's lone semifinalist in the 66th Annual National Merit Scholarship Program, but she was recently named as a finalist. Bryden is one of 15,000 across the nation to have earned finalist standing, according to the National Merit Scholarship Corp. Last year, two Midland County students, Hayden Ham of Lee and Christian Bell of Greenwood, earned spots on the finalist list. Not long after becoming a semifinalist, Bryden completed the following Q&A. School, Trinity School of Midland. GPA, 4.0. College plans, I plan to attend a liberal arts institution and double major in theater and psychology/political science. Following my undergraduate education, I hope to attend law school. Favorite class, psychology, civil rights and civil liberties, or speech and debate. Other honors, National Speech and Debate Association Academic All-American, National Speech and Debate Prepared Prompt Semifinalist, National Speech and Debate Prose and Poetry Quarterfinalist, TAPS State Champion in Reading Writing, Ready Writing, Trinity School Prefect, 5-year Trinity Trustee Scholar, and Pickwick Player Heart of Service Award. Who inspires you academically? My teachers inspire me every day to be better both academically and personally. Throughout my career at Trinity, I have been so blessed to have had incredible teachers. The time and effort they invest in their students pushes us not only to academically achieve, but to value integrity as well. What does it mean to you to be the only National Merit Corporation semifinalist from Midland? I am both surprised and deeply honored to be the only semifinalist from Midland. Considering there is so much talent both at Trinity and throughout Midland, I feel blessed to be able to represent our city on the national level. What would you tell elementary school students about the importance of succeeding in the classroom? While succeeding in the classroom is incredibly important, perhaps more significant is the knowledge you gain prior to that success. Though I have been awarded many accolades for academic achievement, the true success came not from the trophy, but from the wisdom I gained. My advice to any younger student is not to try to succeed academically, but to try your best and actively focus on learning. Pursue subjects you are passionate about and strive to understand the world around you. The achievements will follow. Playful name-calling isn't fun anymore for boyfriend. Dear Abby, my girlfriend and I call each other horrible, disparaging names as a form of love. Recently, I asked her to stop calling me names like that because it was fun at first, but now, not so much. For me, it was just too negative. I love her, and I want to show it by my actions. I want us to be positive, be a positive couple. I now call her BB. Well, she got mad and accused me of not letting her be herself. Am I wrong for asking her not to call me ugly gender-based names? I know she loves me, and I just want her to tone down the name-calling. Is that too much to ask? No, dumb A in California. Dear no, DA. No, it is not too much to ask. Jokes can get old and stale, and the name-calling stopped being cute or fun for you for a while ago. People who love each other are sensitive to the other person's feelings and don't do what your girlfriend is doing. If she persists, it may be time to step back and reevaluate this relationship, because her just being herself will become a turnoff. Dear Abby, my husband of 34 years has really bad table manners. He smacks when he chews, makes gulping noises when he drinks liquids, and stuffs huge amounts of food in his mouth. He once swallowed a whole hard-boiled egg all at once and almost choked. It's gross. I love him, but his lack of manners is embarrassing, especially when we're invited out or are over at a friend's house. What can I do? Signed, Rolling My Eyes in Tennessee. Dear Rolling, have you talked to him about this? If you have, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. Hand him a mirror or record a video of him eating so he can see for himself how unappealing he looks when he does this. If that doesn't persuade him to slow down and take smaller bites, consider putting less food on his plate before serving it. I can't guarantee this will work, but it's worth a try. P.S. A whole egg? Ouch! Dear Abby, after recently having gone through a divorce, my brother has now decided to start a family. He claims he loves her, but I'm afraid she's taking advantage of him. They are both in their mid-30s and blinded by lust. They plan on marrying maybe a year from now. I don't know what to think. On the one hand, I'm happy he has moved on and found a new life. On the other hand, I'm afraid for him, knowing he's vulnerable. How do I cope? Signed, Bewildered Sis in Vermont. Dear Sis, your brother is talking about getting married a year from now. Unless he's putting the cart before the horse by starting a family before the wedding, he seems to be handling things quite well and not rushing into a commitment he can't get out of. Calm yourself. Let this play out and get to know his girlfriend. If you do, you might find you like her. DPS, unattended vehicle hits, runs over Midland man. From staff reports. The Texas Department of Public Safety reported on Thursday that a 70-year-old Midland man died earlier this week after being hit by an unoccupied car. DPS reported that Gilbert Martinez passed away at Midland Memorial Hospital after the incident at 6:15 a.m. Tuesday in the 1300 block of West County Road 114. The Department of Public Safety reported that a preliminary investigation indicated a 2005 Ford Freestyle was in reverse gear and unoccupied, and that the driver pedestrian was outside the vehicle. DPS then reported that the vehicle ran over the pedestrian driver. The crash is still under investigation. Energy briefs from staff reports. WTGS plans virtual luncheon. The West Texas Geological Society will host a virtual lunch March 15th, beginning at 11:30 a.m. Mike Party, CEO of Barrel Oil, will speak on the Permian Basin, what is its future. Reservations are being accepted through March 12th and can be made online at WTGS.org, by email at WTGS@WTGS.org, or by calling 683-1573. There is no charge for the event. SIPES schedules March meeting. Members of the Midland Chapter Society of Independent Professional Earth Scientists will meet March 17th in the upstairs ballroom at Midland Country Club, beginning at 11:15. Guest speaker Robin Vasicek will address operating and living with stripper wells. There is no charge for members, $30 for guests. Reservations are required and can be made by email at george@pemidland.com.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the oil report of the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday, March 6th. DOE Research Director details focus on produced water. The story was written by Mella McEwen. As the U.S. Department of Energy works to oversee the nation's energy resources, it is also engaged in research to better understand what it oversees. Elena Subia Melchert, Director, Upstream Oil and Gas Research Division at the Department of Energy, detailed those efforts during the University of Texas Permian Basin's Water Lecture Series recently. Quote, "We want you to understand what we're doing with upstream activity, why we do it, and how we do it. We have partnerships with the industry, with academia," she said during the virtual event. She detailed the department's establishment of field laboratories, including three in the Permian Basin. Two are hydraulic fracturing test sites established in conjunction with the Gas Technology Institute, and one is for engineered water for improvement of oil recovery from fractured reservoirs in partnership with the University of Texas at Austin. Subsequent generations of field labs bring to 17 the number of labs studying enhanced oil recovery in the conventional space to EOR in the unconventional space to studying everything from geophysics to geochemistry and more. Despite dramatic videos of people near hydraulic fracturing sites lighting water from their faucets on fire, Melchert said the labs have found no adverse effects from fracturing operations. Produced water research is one of the agency's four core research areas alongside onshore basin-specific research, artificial intelligence research, and offshore research. Melchert said her motto is, quote, "Turn produced water from a waste to a resource," end quote. The DOE is in the early research and development stages of a water desalination hub to treat salinity in non-traditional water resources, including produced water. This will be done through materials research and development, new process research and development, modeling and simulation tools, and integrated data and analysis. Between 2012 and 2017, the agency has funded almost 60 water research projects with a total value of more than $100 million. It also became one of the first federal agencies to work with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers on a sustainable produced water policy, regulatory framework, and management in the Texas oil and gas industry from 2019 and beyond. Those projects have focused on wellbore integrity, reduced freshwater use, and developing beneficial uses for treated produced water. In 2018, at a White House roundtable and stakeholder engagement event, the Water Security Grand Challenge was launched. As Melchert noted, quote, "Water is too precious to national security to not have a national strategy associated with it," end quote. The goals of the challenge are to advance transformational technology and innovation to meet global needs for safe, secure, and affordable water by 2030 through desalination technologies, transforming produced water from a waste to a resource, achieving near-zero water impact for new thermoelectric power plants and significantly lower freshwater use intensity within the existing fleet, doubling resource recovery from municipal wastewater, and developing small modular energy water systems for urban, rural, tribal, national security, and disaster response settings. Quote, "We know the industry spends more research dollars than the DOE ever does," she said. The taxpayer will get a return on his tax dollars when that technology is fully integrated, end quote. It's not uncommon, she added, for the agency to launch research projects and someone in the industry to notice its value and take over the effort. Melcher began her career during the George W. Bush administration when she joined the Energy Task Force and wrote the oil and gas technology sections of the president's National Energy Policy in 2001. Under President Obama, she was appointed committee manager of the President's National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling in 2010. Water and Energy Conference will convene in 2022. For 2021, organizers plan to continue providing information through podcasts and other means. The story was written by Mila McEwen. It will be a year before the Permian Basin Water and Energy Conference again convenes in person, but that won't stop the flow of information in the interim. Quote, we will be featuring on our revamped website, which will be published in the next 4 to 6 weeks, monthly podcast topics from the Texas Legislature and New Mexico Legislature and Bureau of Land Management, said Blair Flanagan. Flanagan, who joined the University of Texas Permian Basin earlier this year to organize and oversee the conference, told a reporter telegram by telephone that representatives of the marketing firm helping with the conference will be heading to Austin to help with the podcasts. She said they will have conversations with a variety of people, from Ben Shepard, president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, to local state legislators like Tom Craddock and Brooks Landgraf. Quote, it will be a great way to keep everyone informed and excited about more information in 2022, she said. The conference has already been scheduled for February 22nd through 24th, 2022, at the Barbara and George H.W. Bush Convention Center. It will open February 22nd with a reception at the Petroleum Museum, followed February 23rd through 24th with the conference itself, which will be 2 days instead of the usual three. The importance of meeting in person extends beyond the presentations being made to networking among attendees. Quote, some of the best conversations take place in the back of the room, Flanagan said. Flanagan said since assuming her duties, she has been speaking with conference sponsors and past attendees as to what they want from the conference and how to make it better. She said everyone is looking for information on technology from regulators, from other operators as to their experiences and best practices. While she is not planning to veer significantly from past conferences, she said she hopes to have more breakout sessions where engineers can talk with engineers, financial people with financial people, and regulators with regulators. She also hopes for more involvement from exploration and production companies. Quote, that way we go straight to the source. That's where a lot of the issues are. End quote. The ultimate goal, after the final session and as attendees file out, is, quote, I want them to leave with a sense of purpose and a fuller sense of the scope of the issues and more knowledge than when they walked in the door. I want them to feel they got their time's worth and a productive return on their money. Water and Energy Conference will convene in 2022. For 2021, organizers plan to continue providing information through podcasts and other means. The story was written by Mila McEwen. It will be a year before the Permian Basin Water and Energy Conference again convenes in person, but that won't stop the flow of information in the interim. Quote, we will be featuring on our revamped website, which will be published in the next 4 to 6 weeks, monthly podcast topics from the Texas Legislature and New Mexico Legislature and Bureau of Land Management, said Blair Flanagan. Flanagan, who joined the University of Texas Permian Basin earlier this year to organize and oversee the conference, told the Reporter-Telegram by telephone that representatives of the marketing firm helping with the conference will be heading to Austin to help with the podcast. She said they will have conversations with a variety of people, from Ben Shepard, president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, to local state legislators like Tom Craddock and Brooks Landgraf. Quote, "It will be a great way to keep everyone informed and excited about more information in 2022, she said. The conference has already been scheduled for February 22nd through 24th, 2022, at the Barbara and George H.W. Bush Convention Center. It will open February 22nd with a reception at the Petroleum Museum, followed February 23rd through 24th with the conference itself, which will be 2 days instead of the usual three. The importance of meeting in person extends beyond the presentations being made to networking among attendees. Quote, "Some of the best conversations take place in the back of the room," Flanagan said. Flanagan said since assuming her duties, she has been speaking with conference sponsors and past attendees as to what they want from the conference and how to make it better. She said everyone is looking for information on technology from regulators, from other operators as to their experiences and best practices. While she is not planning to veer significantly from past conferences, she said she hopes to have more breakout sessions where engineers can talk with engineers, financial people with financial people, and regulators with regulators. She also hopes for more involvement from exploration and production companies. Quote, "That way we go straight to the source. That's where a lot of the issues are," end quote. The ultimate goal, after the final session and as attendees file out, is, quote, "I want them to leave with a sense of purpose and a fuller sense of the scope of the issues and more knowledge than when they walked in the door. I want them to feel they got their time's worth and a productive return on their money."
Editor's note. The Reporter-Telegram talked with Midland ISD officials, including Superintendent Angelica Ramsey, about the changes coming to the district's elementary school reading program. Over the next few days, we will look at those components that will be part of the program's rebuilding, including literary strategists, the standardized programs, and expectations of the intersessional calendar that the MISD board debated and approved last week. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HurstNP.com. MISD will not be using the reading angels to describe the interventionists that are expected to play a key role in the rebuilding of the district's reading program. They will be called literacy strategists, and Midland ISD officials describe the role they will play in supporting teachers, helping students, and guiding a program into new times when the district needs it most. In a January meeting, multiple MISD officials stated that the percentage of students in Midland ISD elementary schools needing reading intervention at the elementary school level was greater than 50%. These comments echoed comments made in December when then-interim Superintendent Ann Dixon stated that 56% of second graders were reading at or beyond grade level. The percentage of eighth graders was 36%. That is just more than one-third reading at or above grade level. It will be these literacy specialists that are expected to go into the classroom, get to know those students in need of help, and work with the teachers to be laser-focused on identifying students that will benefit from further support, including during the much-talked-about intercession periods that are part of a new calendar in the 21-22 school year. Midland ISD Chief of Staff Katie Atkins told the Reporter-Telegram that the district discovered there are currently interventionists on most campuses, including those that are called instructional coaches and reading specialists. She said the new position will be streamlined and that those people currently in those positions may not necessarily fit the qualifications of our literacy strategist position. Right now, the job description is being refined and revised and reviewed, Atkins said, and the description will be published shortly. But what we need to make sure is that those people have, first of all, the requisite skills in order to deliver reading instruction. She said the literacy strategist on a particular campus might have a master's certification or be a legacy reading teacher. But it is important they have been reading teachers and have been successful in doing so because they're going to be tasked with supporting teachers in Tier 1 instruction while also working with small groups during those intervention times. A multifaceted role focused on literacy is another way Atkins described the position. She said they will be trained to know the resources that are part of the district's literacy programs, or what Atkins called the comprehensive literacy framework. She also said they will use that knowledge and the knowledge they will have for supplemental materials to address either decoding or comprehension. Superintendent Angelica Ramsey told the Reporter-Telegram that the programs used around the district will be more consistent from campus to campus than they have been in the past. A high-quality, rigorous program is how Ramsey described it. Ramsey said the district she just left, Pleasant Valley School District in Camarillo, California, the literacy specialist needed to know the instruction materials, how to teach other teachers, and how to facilitate for professional development purposes. That collaboration will be expected to take place in Midland. A good strategist, both said, are not only can develop relationships with students, but can use certain demonstrated practices that a teacher can then replicate. The teacher is learning things right there in the classroom and not having to wait to the end of the day, Atkins said. They get that learning and get that support that they need right there, right then. UT Austin won't require SAT or ACT scores for the 2022 applications. By Kate McGee, Texas Tribune. The University of Texas at Austin is suspending the SAT and ACT test scores requirement for fall 2022 applicants, citing continued limited access to testing opportunities for students due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The continuation of the temporary suspension will ensure that testing limitations related to COVID-19 do not affect a student's ability to apply to be considered for admission to UT Austin, the university said in a statement. The flagship university is the latest among schools across the country to extend the temporary hold on the traditional application requirement. Earlier this year, multiple Ivy League universities and others had extended their test optional policies through 2022. In Texas, Rice University in Houston made the similar announcement. The University of Houston system also said it would remain test optional through fall 2022 and would consider making the change permanent. Baylor University also made the standardized tests optional through fall 2023 and said it will reevaluate the policy for future years. Texas A&M University also has extended its policy to 2022 applicants and anticipates 2023 will be test optional as well. Last year, multiple Texas universities temporarily scrapped the testing requirement for 2021 applicants as the College Board canceled test exams and large exam sites were closed, including Texas A&M University, Texas Tech, Texas Christian, and Southern Methodist. SMU also announced Thursday that they would remain test optional for fall 2022 and spring 2023 admissions.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.